Politico Playbook will be in Miami on Friday, June 29th to talk with local candidates and party leaders about what matters most to voters this election cycle. For more about the event and to RSVP, visit politico.com/playbookelectionsflorida.
Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover.
Of course, there are a lot of problems with our president, but I haven't heard anyone argue that he's really there for the right reasons, that he is really trying to do the right thing for the country. I mean, many people who voted for him say, oh, well, he's going to shake things up or whatnot and, you know, try to upend the system. But I don't think anybody looks at our president and says, oh, there's a model of selfless service.
Today's guest, Seth Moulton, a congressman from Massachusetts and the leader of an effort to get other veterans like him. He was a captain in the Marines, enlisted after graduating Harvard, who served 4 tours of duty in Iraq, earning the Bronze Star along the way. He's someone who's gotten Democratic insiders all over the country talking about him in a way that doesn't quite make sense for a guy who's only been in office since 2014, when he beat a longtime incumbent in a Democratic primary, and then held the seat despite an intense race against a Republican. You may know Moulton from leading a charge against Nancy Pelosi, trying to topple her as leader. Or you may know him from some of the media speculation about his future that he stoked. From that and other moves, like taking a trip to Iowa last year. I figured, let's hear it directly from the man himself, since I asked him, as you'll hear, about all the different things that his future could hold, and the only thing he ruled out was running for Pelosi's job himself. Moulton this week is announcing a major expansion of the candidates he's endorsing through his group Serve America. He'll be backing not just military veterans, but veterans of other service as well, like AmeriCorps, and backing candidates for races beyond Congress. That's all in the story that's up on the website over at politico.com, which includes me talking with some of the candidates he's backed and why they think it matters to have his endorsement and why they're so excited that he's come to campaign for many of them in a spike of stops that are also starting this week. He's going to New York, Michigan, and Ohio, and there's going to be much more. Another thing you'll read in there is getting at how Moulton manages to be a hero to some, but drives other people, particularly people in power in Washington, absolutely nuts. So please get on the site and check that out. But I want to talk about something else that happened in this interview. Some of you, hopefully a lot of you, may have read an article I wrote for Politico 2 weeks ago about Barack Obama meeting with prospective 2020 candidates, among others, and giving his advice about how they should approach the years ahead and think about their own plans. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Deval Patrick, Joe Biden, even Eric Garcetti and Pete Buttigieg have been in. I wrote then that Obama had met with at least 9 people who might run, because I thought there was a chance that I might have missed some in my reporting then. But Moulton was not on my list. I thought, from what I had been told, he hadn't been in. And that's the understanding I came into this conversation with. Well, guys, one of the things that I like about these podcast conversations, and I hope you agree, is that you can hear the reporting going on as I'm doing it. And toward the end, you'll hear me say to Moulton that my reporting was that he hadn't been in. And Moulton say back to me that I should check my reporting. So I did. And he was right. Moulton met with Obama in June 2017, which actually makes him one of the first politicians who was in to see Obama after he left the White House, before Bernie Sanders was in, or Mitch Landrieu, or almost any of the others. My guess is that I missed this either because it happened so far back, or because people hadn't been thinking of him as a 2020 candidate. But the point is that my reporting in that article was incomplete, and the way I talked about it with him and here was not correct. But that's what reporting is and what it should be. We go out to get the most accurate information we can, we ask as many people as we can, and hopefully by the time we get to the end of the process, we're as right as we can be. Along the way, there are often moments like these, which hopefully get cleared up like this one did by the time it's public. And that's why I decided to leave that part in, rather than chop it out, when no one but Moulton would be the wiser. Curious what you think about all this. Email me your thoughts about this or anything else with the interview at isaac@politico.com. Or guest suggestions. I try to write back to everyone. Remember also to subscribe and tell everyone you know to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or however you're listening. All those subscriptions help get Off Message out to more and more people. As do all the reviews and ratings you leave, so please do that too. Upcoming episodes are going to include presidential historian Kate Anderson Brower, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, and many more. You're not going to want to miss any of them. And follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover for more from this interview and all sorts of other things I'm working on beyond the podcast. And now, my conversation with Seth Moulton. Can we start by talking about your coffee thing? I was going to ask you about milk. You drink milk.
I love milk. I've always loved milk.
Milk, I think, is what you're better known for, maybe. You drink milk all the time.
Honestly, there's no great secret or philosophy here. I just like it.
And I think is it's like 1% skim
good
milk?
For you, you know? Oh, whole milk.
Whole milk.
Oh, yeah. Come on. let's, you know, you're going to drink milk, so milk, go for it.
You have one cup of whole milk every day.
Oh, no, no. I try to do more than that. But it's just, look, it's just, sometimes it's not available. But if I'm home, you know, I probably have 3 or 4 cups a day. When I was in grad school, I think I had 7. But
is it just your whole life? Or?
Yeah, pretty much my whole life. We always had milk for dinner growing up.
Okay.
And still to this day, you know, if it's still to this day, when I go over to my parents' house for dinner, they serve milk.
It feels like very 1950s. Or...
Well, sometimes the menu at my parents' house is 1950s too. My mother is an extraordinary cook, but we grew up on casseroles and meatloaf and
glasses of milk.
And milk.
And it's 3 cups of coffee per week. No more, no less.
Look, I try to be disciplined. I don't want to get addicted to coffee, but we all need a cup of coffee sometimes.
What happens if you have more than 3 per week?
Nothing disastrous happens.
Let's talk a little bit about just your background. And there's a lot to talk about, but I want to focus on the decision you made to join the Marines. You have a military family?
No, not really. One grandfather who served in World War II.
Right. Generationally, everybody has a grandfather who served in World War II, right? But it was not, so it was not something that was part of your...
Actually, far from it. I mean, my parents both went to Brown University and protested the war. They were not thrilled, shall we say.
They were not thrilled because they don't believe in the military?
Well, I think that fundamentally they have some issues with the military that just came from the 1960s. They don't anymore. They've seen how good it's been for me and how proud I am to have served. But at the time when I was looking to sign up, like most parents, they were just concerned. You know, they didn't want to see me get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't think that joining the military was something that would be helpful to me. And it could be very harmful.
And how old are you when you start having this discussion with them?
In college. Yeah. So I wasn't interested in the military before. I wasn't particularly interested in it growing up or anything like that. But, you know, I spent a lot of time in my college church, and the Memorial Church, as it's called, was built to honor the veterans who died in World War I.
And which college, where are we talking?
At Harvard.
Yeah.
And it's right in the center of the yard. And the church was designed so that when students were coming to service, the students would all enter through a separate entrance right through the World War I memorial to constantly be reminded of that sacrifice. And then about 10 years after it was built, they had to add a massive marble wall for World War II. And you can't sit in that church every Sunday and not think about the young men on that wall.
And you were sitting in that church because you were feeling, were you,
you know, to you be grow up going honest, to
church that much? I would imagine the parents who went to Brown and protested the military were not big churchgoers. Or maybe that's not fair.
We went to church every Sunday growing up.
Really?
But for me, I didn't keep going to church because of a sense of religious obligation. I just felt like it made me a better person. And I was particularly inspired by the preacher at that college church. And his name was Peter J. Gomes. And he talked a lot about the importance of service, about how it's not enough just to believe in service or support others who serve. You ought to find a way to go out and do something yourself to give back. And so when I was approaching graduation, I looked at different options. I looked at the Peace Corps. I looked at teaching overseas, a lot of things that would have been a lot more popular with my parents. But you can't escape all those men, mostly men. There are a few women on the wall of that church. And I think that suddenly being their age, for the first time in my life, I was their age.
Right.
I saw their faces in the faces of my friends. Very different than when you're growing up and these heroes from World War II were of a different generation.
Right.
And
just, you know, gray just hair
very distant.
And, yeah.
Right, right. No, these were people just like my friends and I, and they did one thing. They volunteered. And I decided I was going to volunteer.
Well, I think a lot of them were drafted, and the ones who were
World War II,
right?
So interestingly, I don't know the statistics, but in World War II, it was actually considered a sign of shame if you had to be drafted. You were expected to volunteer, and especially if you went to a place like Harvard, you were expected to be among the first to volunteer. So this was a time when people felt that if you had great opportunity, like being able to go to a great school, you also had great responsibility. And of course, that's changed a lot. I mean, one thing that's striking about this church is you walk in and you see this massive marble wall with hundreds of names from World War II. And then you look on the left side of the church and there's a small brass plaque for the Harvard men who died in Vietnam. That was
And how many, In your graduating class, which is the graduating class of
2001. So I graduated in June of 2001. So it's important to say I didn't know September 11th was going to happen. I didn't know Iraq was going to happen. I didn't know what I was getting into.
How many in the class of 01, class of 2000, 2002, anywhere around there?
I think it was about a dozen. I don't know the exact
number. Per class,
number,
right?
Yeah, something but like it was that. Something yeah. like that. So it was a pretty small number. But a lot of my friends thought it was crazy too. A lot of them didn't understand why I was doing it. But of course, a few months later was September 11th.
Right.
And
you're already enlisted at that point?
Well, I had made the decision to sign up, but I didn't get into the fall class. So my training actually didn't start till January. But as September 11th happened, I mean, I was up on a summer job, you know, on a railroad track crew in the mountains of New Hampshire when literally on September 11th.
We're on a railroad track crew in the mountains of New Hampshire?
Yes. Yeah, that was my summer job. And
doing what?
Literally like swinging a spike hammer and changing out ties. But when
that also, I feel like, is not the usual post-graduation thing for a Harvard student.
You know, I always had jobs working with my hands growing up. I literally one summer an exception. I had an internship, but always. And I, frankly, it's one of the things I miss most about this job. I was out painting my fence last weekend, but in any
work
event,
with your hands in Congress, I guess.
Not if you're doing the right thing. So, September 11th obviously was a shocking experience for everybody. For me, I had friends who were working on Wall Street who had gone to New York right after graduation. Mm-hmm. They literally saw it firsthand. But I was one of the only people in my class who was in a position to actually do something about it. And I was proud that as lines were forming outside of recruiting stations, you know, I had already made that decision to serve.
And you didn't think, okay, now it's real. Like you might actually have to go fight.
Well, actually, you know, what's most interesting is the difference in my reaction versus my parents. Because when September 11th happened and a lot of people started to sign up, I felt vindicated. I felt like all these people who told me that I was wrong to want to serve in the Marines now saw that I was right. Maybe I was just a few months early. My parents thought I would quit.
They thought you would.
My parents thought that, well, and that I should, but my parents thought that faced with an actual war, as opposed to just this sort of adventure of serving in the military, that I wouldn't follow through. And it, to me, just showed how little they understood about why I was doing this and why fundamentally I was going, because I just had so much respect for these 18-year-old young Americans who put their lives on the line for the country. And I just felt like a college kid like me should do my part too.
It must have been a tough conversation with them when you said, oh, I'm actually going to do this, right?
It was. In fact, we were sitting on the couch just glued to the television on September, I don't know, 13th or 14th, I think, following the attacks. And I remember I brought it up with them. I said, well, you know, tomorrow I'm going for my physical. And it was a very difficult conversation, to put it lightly. And sometimes I have students someone recently just, you know, who works on the Hill come up to me and just ask for advice, you know, hey, I'm thinking about going in and having a tough time explaining this to my parents, you know, do you have any advice? And my advice is just plan on not being able to convince them. You know, mothers and fathers for literally thousands of years have not wanted to see their sons or daughters go to war. And you just have to recognize that you'll probably have to make this decision on your own.
There were tears. They were screaming,
that kind of thing. All the above. All the above.
Do you think that veterans make better elected officials?
Well, certainly not as a rule. I mean, there are exceptions to the rule in Congress today. But I do think that people who have had the experience of putting their country first, ahead of their own personal interests, ahead of their own political interests, certainly ahead of their party's interests, I think they tend to have the right values to be serving in our politics. And frankly, I think a lot of people who are serving in politics today don't have those values. You know, they're more interested in just doing what the party leadership says or what's important for their political future rather than what's right for the country or right for the people that they're charged to represent. So look, I mean, we've been focused on supporting veterans in 2018.
Right, that's why I ask.
Yeah, but by the way, not just military veterans either. I mean, military veterans, many of them have literally had the experience of putting their lives on the line for the country. I mean, that's pretty powerful. I mean, I think when you come to Congress and someone says, I really need you to do this political favor, and tries to strong arm you, say, look, I've I've seen tougher challenges. I think I'll do the right thing. But our definition of veteran includes National Service veterans as well. So City Year, AmeriCorps, you know, Peace Corps.
The
National Service realm, people who have made a decision after high school or after college to say, I want to do something to give back. And I'm going to make some personal sacrifices to do so. I'm not going to get paid a lot. I might have to put a uniform on. Might have to put my life at risk or make some personal sacrifices. But it's the right thing to do. And I'm a big believer in National Service, by the way. I mean, I know that's not the point of this, but this interview, we're talking about politics. But I believe we'd be a stronger country if more young people felt an obligation, just a personal obligation.
Well, there was that idea that Charlie Rangel, the former congressman from New York, said that there should be the draft for everybody. It would change the way that military did things, or that the idea of like a national, like a required service thing. Is that what you mean?
No, I mean, I think there's great virtues to having a volunteer army where people want to sign up. That's what we have in the military today. But the last time I checked, there were over 5 AmeriCorps applicants for every slot.
Yeah.
So even if you just expanded National Service to meet the demand, a lot more young Americans would be serving. And by the way, I think if you did that, even more would get interested and more would want to serve.
Do you think it matters that Donald Trump didn't serve?
I don't even know where to begin with Donald Trump. Of course, there are a lot of problems with our president, but I haven't heard anyone argue that he's really there for the right reasons, that he is really trying to do the right thing for the country. I mean, many people who voted for him say, oh, well, he's going to shake things up or whatnot and, you know, try to upend the system. But I don't think anybody looks at our president and says, oh, there's a model of selfless service.
I mean, I ask because this was an issue with Barack Obama. He didn't serve either. Now, he was not of the age
Vietnam.
Right. And now he could have volunteered the way that you did. Right. But Donald Trump did find his way out of the draft.
He took five deferments, right. You know, 5 excuses to let other people go in his place. 5 times when he let another young American go and risk his life in Donald Trump's place. And I wonder if the president has ever thought about that. I wonder if the president has ever thought about meeting the people who went in his place. You know, I'm sure they're not all alive today. Some of them lost their lives. He could stay home and, you know, build on the fortune that his father gave him.
You think it matters that he hasn't visited the troops yet?
I've talked to a lot of troops who don't want to see him. You know, one of the
Why
most
Why don't frequent- they want to see him? He's their commander in chief.
Well, I mean, and look, I mean, I'm certainly not speaking for all the troops. I would never pretend to do that. And I'm sure there are some troops that support him. But you want to have a commander in chief that you look up to. I mean, I remember that experience in the military. You want to have someone that even if you don't agree with, you can respect. I mean, I served under George W. Bush. I didn't vote for him twice. I didn't agree with his war. But I never thought that George W. Bush would, you know, collude with Russia, our greatest enemy.
That Donald Trump did?
There's an awful lot of evidence that he has. I mean, already 2 people in his campaign have been indicted for it. And he certainly has been unbelievably soft on Russia and made no effort to stop them from getting involved in our elections again. I mean, George W. Bush, for all the things I disagreed with, he would be strong on Russia because he knows they're an enemy. So that's the contrast.
Well, he said he looked into Putin's soul and there was good in there, whatever the quote was.
Putin hadn't meddled in our elections. Look, the point is that you're not expected to agree with the politics of your commander-in-chief, but you ought to respect his or her integrity. You know, when I signed up for the Marines, I didn't know anything about the military. I go to Quantico for training. And one of the first things you learn is that you can drop out of a run and they'll give you another shot. You can fail a test and they'll let you retake it. But if you lie about anything, you're gone that afternoon. That's how fundamental integrity is in the military. And we have a commander in chief who lies many times a day. We have a commander in chief that we fundamentally can't trust. You know,
do you
another
think
time,
he should be gone? Do you think he should be impeached?
Well, impeachment is a tricky political question. And I think
as a moral stance. I mean, by the way that you're talking about the way things went in the military, right?
You know, I recently read the biography of John Adams, and it noted how he was the first president to live in the White House. Mm-hmm. And he gave a grace over dinner for his first meal. And that Those words, I guess, have been, I've never seen them, but I guess they've been put on the wall in the White House.
They're over the fireplace.
And sounds like you know more about this than I do, which is not surprising. But
it's like a blessing of the house.
It's like a blessing of the house. And it says, may only good and honest men live here. And, you know, sadly, I can't say that Donald Trump is a good or an honest man.
But what's the answer on the impeachment question then?
Well, look, I mean, impeachment is a complicated thing. I think it only happens when you have bipartisan agreement that he needs to be impeached, and we're certainly not there. And by the way, I think this is a terrible thing to be talking about for Democrats right now. This is not the
let's separate the moral and the political issue there. Morally, do you think that he should be removed from office based on your values in the way that you think about things?
Look, the problem is it's not up to my moral values. I mean, it's written the grounds for impeachment are in our Constitution.
If you could make it happen, would you want it if it was in your power?
If Republicans agreed, not all Republicans, but if a consensus in the country on both sides of the aisle,
you think we're far enough down that we've seen enough that you feel
that then I would look. I think that our president is dangerous for our country. I think he puts our national security at risk. I think he's demeaned us across the world. He's not following our Constitution. Certainly not following our values. I think he's a very dangerous president. And I say that as someone who's very bipartisan. I mean, I'm someone who actually ran on a platform of bipartisanship when I first got elected. I work very hard to work across the aisle. I mean, statistically, I'm very bipartisan.
Yeah, even as a Democrat from Massachusetts. You know,
I'm the most bipartisan member of the Massachusetts delegation, although some people tell me that's a low bar. But look, I'm someone who respects the people on the other side of the aisle, even if I don't agree with them. But I don't respect our president. And by the way, I do respect people who voted for him. And I think that's an important distinction. I don't respect our president, but I understand why a lot of Americans were hurting so much and are still hurting in this country that they took a flyer on a guy who rides to work in a golden elevator because they thought he might upend the system.
And you mean hurting economically, and this is something you've talked about a lot, that the Democrats aren't saying the right thing about...
Well, I don't think we're saying much of anything.
What do you think Democrats should be saying? What's the answer there?
Look, I think we need to actually have a vision ourselves. I don't think that Democrats start winning again until we start leading again. And that's why I'm so excited about this new generation of leaders that's coming up that I'm supporting and endorsing. And they're just extraordinary people who I think are going to bring leadership and vision to this party again. And people are looking for that. You know, they want to know, what's the Democratic economic plan? You know, what's the Democratic plan for national security? My vision for the country is a country where everybody has a job that matters, no matter where you live.
I think everybody would say that, right? When I hear from some of your Democratic critics, and you've got a few of those out there, is that they...
Everybody
say,
does.
But for your Democratic critics, is that they say, okay, well, Moulton always comes after us for not having an economic message, but he doesn't... What would he have us say?
Well, actually, I think that everybody deserves a job that matters. And that means if you live on the coast, you're going to do well.
That's a good goal.
You keep interrupting. So that's the goal. And that means that if you live on the coast, you have a good job. But if you live in middle America, you're part of the future of the economy, too. And here's the key. Donald Trump says that immigrants are taking jobs and we need to go back into the coal mines. All right. What a backwards looking message that's so out of touch with reality. Here's what's actually happening. Immigrants aren't taking jobs, robots are. Mm-hmm. Jobs are getting automated out of existence. People are seeing factory jobs just go away. Some of them are going overseas, but a lot of them are just going to machines. And so what we need to do is be honest about that, really have the courage to be honest about the challenges that we face and say, I want to see Americans succeed in the economy of the future. Mm-hmm. That means if you lost your job, we're going to train you for a better job. Doesn't mean you're just going to go to work at McDonald's. We're going to train you for a better job. That means that we are going to invest in AI. You know, this is some automated, artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. This is something that China is doubling down on. I mean, they're kicking our butt in artificial intelligence. It's a huge concern to me from a national security perspective, but it should be a concern to us from an economic perspective as well. I want to see us invest in that.
Well, you see how vulnerable we were just in the election hacking technologically, right? And that hasn't been built up. But overall, we're not as a country working on...
We're totally missing the boat. And it's not just that our elections are going to keep getting hacked or that we're not going to be able to compete with the latest Chinese military robots. Those are real concerns. Mm-hmm. They could literally end our country. But it also just means that we're not going to have the best companies. We're not going to have the best jobs. We're not going to be the world leader that we've been in tech and in the future of the economy if we keep focusing on the past.
So it's job training. It's focusing on building.
Well, it's job training, and it's a real, really rethinking education. The Democratic Party always talks about how everybody should have an opportunity to go to college. And look, I agree with that. If you want to go to college, you should have the opportunity to do so, and you shouldn't be have a lifelong burden of debt when you get out. But what about vocational school? You know, I never chose a Marine for a mission based on the degree he had hanging on his wall. And a lot of people out there have great, important jobs. They're electricians, they're plumbers, they're doing things that are essential, they're important, and they're hard. And they're good paying jobs, by the way, too. But we don't seem to respect them very much. And we don't give people the opportunities to go to vocational school. I literally have lines out the door of the vocational schools in my district. Mm-hmm. And all Democrats seem to talk about is going to college. If you want to go to college, you should have the opportunity to go to college. But if you want to go to vocational school, you should have that opportunity as well. And you should be respected for your job when you come out. And the irony of this situation is that when you actually look at how these jobs are changing and going away, it's actually much easier to program a robot to program a computer than it is to program a robot to fix an electrical cabinet. Mm-hmm. You know, if we have some electrical problem in the building right now, you have to call an electrician. That's not going to be a robot for a long time. But literally, computers are already programming themselves. Right. So we need to make sure that we're training people to be, you know, the machinists and electricians and plumbers that we still need.
You have your Serve America, which is your group that you have been building out endorsements on. It's you and your staff. The Democratic Congressional Committee has huge staff that figures out what to do with candidates and how to back them. What is the process that you go through to figure out who gets the Moulton backing?
Well, let me start by just saying why on earth I started doing this in the first place. And maybe that'll explain the process a bit. You know, look, when I got elected, I didn't have a background in politics. I mean, I got out of the Marines, I went to business school, and the first job I took was in Dallas, Texas. You don't move to Dallas, Texas if you're planning to run for office in Massachusetts. So this is not what I expected to do. So
politics was never an interest when you were a kid.
I didn't study it in school. Yeah. I mean, look, I followed it. Sure. Yeah. I mean, I was in a war that was, you know, had a lot of politics in it, but I certainly didn't see myself sitting here. And then I decided to run because I missed the sense of purpose I had in the Marines. And I actually got recruited by a nonprofit called New Politics, which is doing extraordinary things. And we're closely working with for Serve America, that's out there just recruiting National Service veterans to run for Congress at a time when we've never had fewer veterans in Congress in our nation's history than we do today. And by the way, they don't just recruit for Congress. They recruit up and down state and local races. They're really building this, this stable, this bench of next generation leaders. New Politics is bipartisan. Serve America, my group, is just Democratic, but we both recognize that we need new, better service-driven people in politics. So anyway, they called and said I should think about running for office. I said, this is crazy. What are you talking about?
Especially because there wasn't an open seat, You were going to have to run.
Well, literally that night, I was having dinner with a friend whose father was in politics, and his father was in town. And it was like a reporter like you. And I said, you know, you'll never believe what happened to me. Someone called and said I should run for office. And his first question to me naturally was, well, who are you going to run against? And I couldn't even remember the name of my own congressman. So this is not where I expected to be. And after I got elected, to fast forward a bit here, I just tried to be a good congressman. You know, I wasn't interested.
After you got elected, and it's like important, you beat an incumbent Democrat in a primary.
Yeah.
That's how you got elected.
Yeah. The 18-year incumbent. Yeah. It was a tough race. It was actually, I think I was the only Democrat to beat an incumbent in a primary in 2014. So it's not a typical way to get to Congress, but I thought I could do a better job. And I ran on a message of bipartisanship that we've got to be willing to work together to get things done. And by the way, the primary was the toughest, but the general election was tough too. I mean, this was a frontline district, which means it was a top Republican target, a top defensive priority.
It was where Republicans thought they could pick up a seat in Massachusetts.
Right. So anyway, that was 2014, and I spent my first 2 years just trying to do a good job as a congressman for my district. And I think I got named the most effective Democratic freshman or something like that. So we were just doing good work. You know, we were just, you know, getting bills passed, working across the aisle, listening to constituents. But November 2016 was a wake-up call for me, as it was for so many other Americans. And I woke up the next day, I was shocked, and like so many people across the country, I just started saying, you know, what can I do? Mm-hmm. How can I have an impact? And I decided that the best thing that we can do as Democrats is win back the House. I think that's the most realistic way we can put mm-hmm. a check on President Trump. And I mean, it's extraordinary. I even hear Republicans, not just outside of Congress, but even a few in Congress saying, you know, the best thing for the country would be for Democrats to win control of the House. And so I said, let's focus on the House. Let's focus on veterans because they're sort of my niche and they're mm-hmm. really good in swing districts that we need to win. But most of all, let's not try to just win to take back control. Let's try to fundamentally change Congress. Let's try to get people here who can work together, who can actually change the status quo. Because part of the lesson of November 2016 is that there are a lot of Americans who are just frustrated mm-hmm. with our government and want to throw it all out. So that's how this all started. And we started just, you know, a couple friends of mine I encouraged to run, and a few people reached out to
all veterans, right?
All veterans, yeah. A few people reached out to me. But, you know, the best recruiter out there isn't Seth Moulton. The best recruiter out there is our commander-in-chief, Donald Trump. He's the one who's convincing so many veterans who, you know, served the country before to decide to serve the country again. So we got together a small list of candidates, and we started raising money for them and started trying to mentor them and help them figure out how to do this whole thing. Almost all of them first-time candidates, so they didn't know how to put together a campaign or hire staff or anything like that. And to be honest, it just took off. I mean, we've gotten more and more candidates who I didn't recruit, but are just coming to me and saying they want to be a part of this movement. We've gotten a lot of interest from supporters across the country who want to volunteer, who want to contribute money to these races. And so we've decided.
But there's a process that you want that you go with this one rather than that
one.
So what's the demarcation?
You're absolutely right. So we have three criteria. Number one, they've got to be great servant leaders, people who are fundamentally doing this for the right reason. Mm-hmm. And that's a criteria that I don't think you see in many other organizations or many other lists of candidates. That's our most important criteria, great leaders. That's where we start. Number two, they've got to be in key races in winnable districts. You know, we're not going to just endorse an easy Democratic seat. We're not going to endorse a seat that's so deep red we don't have a prayer. And then the third thing is they've got to be the best general election candidate, even in contested primaries. So this means that there are some extraordinary veterans out there that we haven't endorsed because they just don't meet, you know, they're not the best general election candidate for whatever
reason. And some that you have endorsed have lost their primaries.
And that's right. Also, some that we have endorsed have lost their primaries. Not many, but a few. You know, unfortunately, I think those seats may be difficult to win now. But the bottom line is these are extraordinary people. They're people like Amy McGrath down in mm-hmm. Kentucky, the first woman to fly an F-18 in combat in the Marine Corps. Just an extraordinary leader. I mean, there are people in Kentucky who will vote for her not because she's a Democrat, but just because she's an extraordinary leader.
And being a well-known political figure in Kentucky, Mayor of Lexington.
Who the Democratic Party had actually recruited to run against her, which I just think was a mistake. I mean, I my judgment was that she was the best general election candidate. And I think that everybody agrees with that now.
What about somebody like MJ Hagar in Texas? She's running in a harder district, but as a woman who is in the military.
Well, we've been following her race closely, and we're strongly considering endorsing her. You know, I sometimes joke that we don't have binders full of veterans. You know, like Romney said he had binders full of
That's
women.
That's your former governor.
my former governor. No, but we literally have spreadsheets where we're trying to track all these races because it's an embarrassment of riches. There are so many talented veterans running on the Democratic side of the aisle this year to try to put a check on the president, to try to change our politics, that we have to be very selective in the ones that we endorse. And so there are a lot of candidates we're watching closely, and we plan to endorse more. But the other thing we're doing is we're expanding beyond veterans.
Right.
Because as this movement has taken off, I've realized that we're kind of just scratching the surface here. And there are a lot of great service-driven leaders who just don't happen to be veterans.
Yeah.
And so we're going to start endorsing people who are running for Congress and are service-driven. They're great leaders. They're the kind of people we want here, but they just didn't happen to serve in the
But also people service. Who aren't just running for the House, right?
And that's right. We're also going to move down ballot to state and local races because the other thing we've really come to realize is that we have a lot of work to do as a party to build our bench. And it can't be just people who have done their time in the system. It's got to be people who are getting in, who are real leaders, who have led in some other capacity in the business world, in the private sector, in the public sector somewhere else.
Does it get too broad, though? Then it's just like people that Seth Moulton likes who feel...
No. Well, is that a risk? Of course it is. Yeah, we got to be conscious of that. We got to be careful that we're really abiding by these criteria. And it's why I take time to just get to know the candidates, to talk with them. I like to, you know, sit down with them or go on a run or something, to really get to know them and try
That's
to fundamentally.
That's the endorsement interview is a run?
Not always, but sometimes. Hey, whenever you can get time. And sometimes we have to meet on the run. But no, the point is I want to get to know these people and understand why they're doing this.
What do you think needs to be done about Nancy Pelosi? You are one of her great critics. There is a lot of question about what her future would be if the Democrats take the House or if they don't take the House. You would not want to see her be the leader anymore after November, no matter what.
Look, I've been very clear. I think it's time for a new generation of leadership in the party. And Leader Pelosi has done extraordinary things. I mean, she's a master legislator in her own words. We wouldn't have Obamacare without her. And she should be respected for those things. But I think it's time to focus on the future. I think it's time to have a new generation of leaders stepping up. And there are extraordinary Democrats, both in Congress and coming into Congress, who represent that new generation and I think can really take us forward. But again,
that's what the party needs. It needs fresh faces.
I think we do. I think we need fresh faces, fresh ideas, a vision, and leadership that's truly invested in building the bench, not clearing it of people who might be challenging leadership.
Well, let me ask you about, I don't want to do too much about presidential contest here, but what about Joe Biden? He's somebody that you've developed a friendship with.
I have tremendous respect for
him. I mean, he would be 78 years old if he ran and won. I mean, it'd be 78 years old 2 weeks after the election,
I'm not going to discriminate based on age. I mean, he's an extraordinary...
He's not a fresh face.
Well, fair enough. I think he's an extraordinary man, an extraordinary leader for the country. I think he's also someone who, frankly, I mean, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think he's also, I mean, look, one of the reasons he took some time to mentor me is because he said, we need new Democrats too. We need new people to come up. So I think when I go around the country, I hear a lot of Democrats all over America say, yes, it's time for a new generation of leadership. Yes, the Republicans are terrible. Trump is awful and the Republicans in Congress won't stand up to him. But we need some new leadership in our party as well.
And it's not just Biden, right? The other front runners, the basic speculation here, are Bernie Sanders, who's a year older than Biden, and your senator and an early supporter of yours, Elizabeth Warren, who is 68 now, I believe, right?
Look, here's the other thing. I think it is a huge mistake for Democrats right now to be focused on 2020. And I know the pundits always like to talk about it and, you know, put money on who's going to win, who's going to run, whatever. I think it's like political malpractice. If we can't figure out how to win in 2018, we're not in good shape for 2020 anyway. And we have an urgent problem in this country where a lot of people are hurting, where kids are literally in cages at the border because of our reckless president. And we've got to put a check on this White House. And we do that by winning in 2018.
But in terms of the leadership of the party, those are the best known leaders at this point, whether or not they're going to be presidential candidates.
You're making my case. I mean, the point is that...
But that's a case...
Well, here's the thing is, I mean, one of the things that Leader Pelosi has said is, I want to stay in because a woman needs a seat at the table, at the leadership table. And when I look around our party, I see extraordinary women who are leaders. People, some of whom you don't hear very much about, like Marsha Fudge from Ohio, who's so respected in the House and in the caucus, like Terry Sewell,
from Alabama,
brilliant lawyer from Alabama with all sorts of fancy degrees, but someone who really understands the people of Alabama. So I don't understand why Leader Pelosi doesn't see these other extraordinary women who could be taking that seat. And I think would really take us forward.
A lot of people love you and think you're great and obviously are running to your endorsement. You also...
Well, look at my Twitter feed. There are also plenty of haters.
Well, I was going to say to you, and not all of them are on Twitter. You know, there are a lot of people, not just Nancy Pelosi, but there are others who what I hear from them is you're out for yourself. This is about building your own brand, everything that you're doing. Why do you think you strike people that way? Why does that impression come across?
I think it's just a good way to attack me. And I mean, look, to be honest, it kind of is a good way to attack me because it just hurts, because nothing could be farther from the truth. I mean, I didn't sign up for the Marines because I was looking for a good or easy job for myself. I did it because I thought it was the right thing to do for my country and because I had so much respect for these these amazing kids, I mean, literally some of the best Americans I've ever met in my life, who don't have any of the opportunities that I had growing up, being able to get into a good school, go to mm-hmm. college and everything, and who do it as well. And, you know, to be honest, when I signed up for the Marines, I figured I would do my 4 years and I would kind of check that box.
Mm-hmm. And go into your business career.
Yeah, just go make money, build a family, whatever, yeah. grow a family. But when I got out, like a lot of veterans, I found that I missed it much more than I expected. I missed the sense of purpose that I had, that even in the midst of a war I disagreed with, every single day my work impacted the lives of other mm-hmm. people. And there was actually a day in 2004 after a pretty rough day when a young Marine in my platoon said, you know, sir, you ought to run for Congress someday so that this shit doesn't happen again. And look, he didn't convince me because I told you, I came back, I moved to Dallas, Texas, right? I wasn't planning to run for Congress in Massachusetts, but I did think back to him and I thought back to what he said and the fact that, you know, we aren't going to change our politics if people aren't willing to stand up and run. But, you know, another thing I learned in the Marines is that when you stick your head up as a leader, people like to shoot you down.
What happened that day when that guy said that to you?
Look, I mean, I didn't go into the details. I don't like telling war stories, but it's just a rough, frustrating day where I think people were like, what the hell are we doing here? You know, why are we here? Why are we in this war? It's not going well.
People getting shot or?
I mean, look, I'm not going to, I don't even remember the exact details of what happened that particular day, but that certainly, you know, was an experience that we had as a platoon. And it really puts things into perspective. And the point is that after that experience of serving in the Marines and missing it more than I ever imagined. I mean, some people must listen to this and think, God, how can you miss being in a war? But I miss those guys. I miss the commitment that we all had to our country. I miss the sense of purpose that we had every single day. And then you come back and you see a country that's just not living up to the values that we fought for, that we literally put our lives on the line for, that we believed so fundamentally that we were willing to risk everything to achieve. Yeah. And I think, you know, when you're a Marine, you don't just sit down and say, we'll just watch it happen. You try to get up and change it. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Is there anything you think that for the people that you do rub the wrong way, that's just the way it is because you're pushing hard against the yeah. status quo? That there's okay. nothing you're, right?
And also, I mean, the other experience of, I mean, not to make light of it, but the other experience of being in Iraq is you're trying to do something that you think is the right thing and people are literally trying to kill you for it. Right. I mean, people are literally shooting at you. Yes. I mean, so, you know, I may get some snipes from yeah. Leader Pelosi's office, but, you know, she's not shooting at me. I mean, I think you got to put it into perspective. I mean, yeah. everyone has critics and better to be the person in the arena, you know, fighting it out than outside, as Teddy Roosevelt so eloquently said.
I know that you're focused on this year. Let's just talk a little bit about what the future might hold for you. Massachusetts, there are two Senate seats. Both of them are held by people who I don't think most people expect to go out of those Senate seats unless Elizabeth Warren is elected president anytime soon. There's a governor's race this year, but depending on how that goes, then there might be an opening in 2022. There definitely will be an election, might be an open seat. Is any of that interesting to you?
I think if you followed me around like literally 24/7, you would be absolutely shocked about how little we talk about this, like literally not at all. I mean, and maybe I'm just politically naive or maybe I'm not as calculating as I should be or something like that, but I'm just still trying to serve my country. And if there's a different or better way to serve, then I'd be willing to look at that opportunity. But remember, I got here because I was literally living in Dallas, Texas, right. not planning to run at all, and decided here's an opportunity to serve and I'm going to give it a shot. So I'm not coming at this with some long-term political plan or something like
that. So what is that, like the morning after the election, the week after the election, you start thinking about that?
I just think that, you know, I look at where I can have the biggest impact. I mean, I also didn't expect to be someone supporting all these extraordinary veterans running for Congress. We've endorsed, I think, 23 now, just of the core group of service veterans. We're now going to expand that even further. This is just a place where I saw that I could make an impact. I could be a small part of being a change. And so I decided to step up and do it.
What about running for leader in the House?
Well,
is that something that you would still be in your seat in the House and people look at what's going on and say, okay, you've sounded out the argument against Pelosi, talked about the need for fresh faces, the need for somebody who thinks of service, right?
Since I don't sit around calculating my political future, I can't tell you what I do plan to run for, but it's a little bit easier to tell you what I don't plan to run for. And honestly, I don't have any interest in being the speaker. And it's because I think to be an effective speaker, you have to be very good at the sort of transactional inside mm-hmm. politics and understanding, you know, favors. And I mean, look, I'll walk into a room and these two Democrats will be going at it or something. And I'll have to look to one of my friends and say, you know, what's going on with them? And he's like, oh, Seth, come on. Don't you know, like 8 years ago, this, you know, I don't know any of this stuff.
And that's what Nancy Pelosi is very good at.
She's great at that. Yeah. She's great at that. And there are other people who are great at it in our caucus who I think would be good at, you know, being able to put together these voting coalitions and, you know, trade committee assignments for votes or whatever they do. But that's just, it's not my thing. It's not interesting to me. And so it's another example of where I don't think I was the best person to challenge Pelosi. I just heard a lot of people talking about it and nobody doing it. So I decided, all right, I'll do it.
But that gets people saying like, oh, that's nice. He throws bombs and then he's not, you know, okay, tough guy. You want to lead the conference? Go ahead, lead the conference.
As I've said many times, there are lots of critics. I mean, everyone can find some complaint or whatever. But, you know, that's not actually been my experience. Since I initially just simply wrote this letter and got people from every diverse corner of the caucus to sign it, to simply say, give us a chance. Let's allow other voices mm-hmm. to be heard. Let's just allow other people to run. I mean, I didn't come at this because I was supporting Tim Ryan against right. her. I just said, let's let other people run. And ever since then, I have had so many fellow members of my caucus come up and just kind of pat me on the back and say, good job.
You like, know, thanks for breaking the dam, basically.
Thanks for sort of breaking the dam. Yeah. And the problem is that many of them just, you know, check behind them to see who's looking first.
Well, but you are a Democratic.
That's a little bit controversial. But some of them have come out publicly since then. Some of them have said that behind the scenes and then come out publicly. And look, you know, the number of Pelosi allies who have told me you're doing the wrong thing and you need to back off is so far zero.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people recognize that it's time for a new generation of leadership. It's time for change. We've got to be focused on the future. But it's just hard to get there.
So I'm going to ask you about another race that I'm curious whether it falls into things you can rule out or things that you're going to not talk about, which is the presidential one that there's that chatter that
definitely
is there.
can agree not to talk about that.
So that's something that is an open question. What do you say to the people who
those are those nice words that you just chose for me?
Well, I mean, for you, I mean, there are people who would say like, oh, come on, like this guy is a 2-term congressman.
I mean, I'm 39 years old. Right. I think I'm a bit young to be the president of the United States, but. But, you know, it's very new to this whole political thing. But, well, I mean, look, again, I'm
you'd
flattered.
Be 41 by 2020.
Look, I'm flattered that some people, I don't know, doesn't seem too old, but I'm flattered that some people have suggested that. But it should not be what we're talking about right now. We've got to win in 2018. The stakes are too high for too many Americans. When you see what happens just every single week, and it's, yes, it's this unbelievably despicable scene of kids being ripped away from their parents and put in cages because of this administration and because we don't have a check on the administration in Congress. But it's also just a lot of people who, you know, thought they'd get a better job under Trump and aren't. People who thought that our country would be safe and instead they're worried about nuclear war. Mm-hmm. It's about kids like the school group that I had visit from a rural school in my district. And they were standing on the Capitol steps earlier this week. And I just asked them, I asked these young kids, I said, how many of you are worried about getting shot in school? And all the hands went up. That's messed up.
Yeah.
If you'd asked me when I was their age, if I was worried about getting shot in school, I wouldn't have raised my hand. I mean, that's how
it's a real concern that people have.
Yeah. And, you know, Trump isn't willing to fix it. I guess he probably knows he would never pass a background check for a gun. But the point is that...
Why do you think he'd never pass a background check?
No, that's not good.
No.
I mean, I'm making a joke, but I think it's probably true. Anyway, the point is that there are a lot of real problems that everyday Americans face right now. And we're not doing enough to change that. And we have an opportunity in 2018 by winning back the House. And I think it's the right thing to do for our country. But we're not going to win if we're not willing to look ourselves in the mirror as Democrats and recognize that we lost. We lost election after election. We can't keep doing the same old thing where we just seem to be throwing the same old solutions and the same, you know, sort of existing leadership at really new problems that are facing our country. And that's not working. But the exciting thing is there's a new generation of Democrats coming who I think can make a change.
It's June. You're talking about elections in November. Let's leave it at this. I know you're hopeful and you're ambitious.
I'm hopeful, but I don't think it'll be easy. I think it's going to be a hard slog.
How close is the Democratic Party to learning what it needs to learn between now and November, between now and the next presidential election?
I think as a party, we have a lot of work to do. But when you look at these individual races and the candidates, the leaders who are stepping up, I think they get it. You know, I was on the ground campaigning with Connor Lamb, knocking on doors with him.
Who won that special election in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. And by the way, it was extraordinary candidate, great guy. And people saw that really from the district, understands the needs and desires of the people in his district. I mean, he really represents his constituents, which is his job.
And notably, the only people who came who he wanted to be there basically from outside of the district politically to come campaign for him were you, Joe Biden, Joe Kennedy, and then Tim Ryan was there at the very end, right?
Well, look, the point is that he is the kind of next generation leader that we need in our party. And I don't even agree with him on every issue, but I'm sure as hell glad that we've got a Democrat in that seat now rather than another Republican who's going to refuse to stand up to the president. But there was it was a tough race. Yeah. It was a really tough race. It was a race that he won by 500 votes, and it took a lot of work every step of the way. And one of the things that he showed on the ground is he showed courage. He showed political courage. He was willing to stand up to his party. He was willing to do the right thing for his constituents, even if it wasn't what the political establishment in Washington is saying. And I think you see that in all the candidates that I've endorsed and in many more. You see this new generation of Democratic leaders stepping up to lead again, to win again, and take this country back. And that's why I'm hopeful.
Last question here. Do you want to see Barack Obama out there a lot? He is the voice of the past in a way. Is he a part of the Democratic Party's future?
I would love to have his help wherever he can be helpful. But the best thing that I think he can do, not that I'm, it's presumptuous of me to say, but it seems to me that the best thing he can do is exactly what I've heard he's doing, which is just, you know, trying to think about this next generation of leaders and encourage people to get involved.
I think you haven't had one of those meetings with him, right? I reported about it a couple of weeks ago.
the point is that that there is this new generation coming, and I think he sees that too, and he's excited about it.
Why do you think you haven't been in for one of those meetings?
the meetings are confidential, so I'm not gonna go there. What the president is doing is recognizing the same thing I see, which is that it's time for a new generation of Democratic leaders. And it's not just something that Barack Obama and Seth Moulton see, it's what Democrats across this country see. And it's even what some Republicans see. They want some vision, they mm-hmm. want some leadership, and they believe a new generation of Democrats can take us there.
All right. Congressman Seth Moulton, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
So, what do you make of the way Moulton answered that question about the Obama meeting? Or the one about impeachment, or the one about whether he'd run for president? Email me at isaac@politico.com and let me know. Thanks as always to Zach Stanton for producing. Remember to subscribe. Coming up, we're going to run the gamut. Presidential historian Kate Anderson Brower, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, and many more. All the way into the summer, and as those crucial midterms get closer. Follow me on Twitter @IsaacDover for more news, interesting angles, and thoughts on these podcasts and much, much more. And catch you next time on Off Message.